Welcome to Your Call. Rose Aguilar is off today. I'm Angie Cuero sitting in for her. And because it's Monday, it's our One Planet series. In George Orwell's 1984, the slogan of the omnipotent, all-powerful party is this: who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. The party's Ministry of Truth works around the clock, intercepting, manipulating, rewriting, and disappearing undesirable information. As soon as the Trump administration took office in January, it began deleting mentions of climate change from federal government websites. Thus began concerted efforts to silence discussion and action about climate realities, threats to the environment, public health, sea level rise, and more. 6 months in, and it really has just been 6 months, the battle against data and information is taking more hostages. Last week, the Environmental Protection Agency announced it would eliminate its Office of Research and Development, primarily responsible for the agency's scientific research. Hundreds of chemists, biologists, toxicologists, and other scientists will be fired. More than 20 decades' worth of national climate assessments has vanished from government websites. Scientists working on the newest reports there were dismissed. More web pages and data have disappeared. That includes tools and information intended to help farmers and state and local governments measure pollution and weather patterns. But people are fighting back, as well as organizations. Some quashed content is legally required to be publicly available, so those removals are being legally challenged. Even before data started being deleted, groups prepared to preserve the crucial data and keep it public. This hour, the battle over climate and environmental data. What's under threat, what the stakes are, and who is working to save it. Gretchen Gerke is founder and co-founder and web monitoring program leader at the Environmental Data and Governance Initiative. EDGE is a network of experts and activists that, among many things, tracks changes to federal environmental information. Gretchen, I assume that means you are very busy these days. Thank you for making time.
Thank you for inviting me. Yes, we are quite busy.
Jeremy Simons is with us as well, senior advisor at the Environmental Protection Network. Some of his former jobs include climate privacy policy advisor at the EPA, deputy staff director for the U.S. Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. He's also worked for the National Wildlife Federation for 12 years. He was vice president of political affairs at the Environmental Defense Fund. These days, he's a consultant working on climate change, energy, and the environment. Equally busy, I'm sure, so welcome to you as well, Jeremy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, last week, the EPA confirmed what was leaked a few months ago, and that is, as I just mentioned, the elimination of the Office of Research and Development. Jeremy, you worked at the EPA. Can you tell us what the ORD does and what the elimination of the agency and the hundreds of scientists who work there, at least a portion of them, what does that mean? What does that come down to? And how will that affect how the EPA functions?
Well, it's the backbone of the science that tells us what we need to do to protect the air our children breathe and the water our family drinks. And, you know, this is the job of EPA, and you can't do it without starting with science. EPA works under Republican and Democratic presidents to fulfill its mission of protecting public health and the environment. And that means they follow the law, it means they follow the science, at least they did until this administration.
Now, is the EPA's ORD actually doing the research? Are they compiling the research? Are they analyzing it? What exactly is it doing?
Well, they do a lot of the research that states and businesses and tribes really depend on to go the next level. So they identify emerging threats like we're seeing with forever chemicals or PFAS, microplastics. They also are responsible for bioterrorism attacks. I remember when I was working in Washington when the anthrax attacks happened in Capitol Hill, and no one knew how to deal with that. It was EPA science office that really came in and figured out the protocols that are still in use today for handling, you know, threats like that. It's the best and the brightest. I mean, that's what our government was. You know, when government's at its best, it's attracting best and brightest, and that's the people at EPA. They don't work in isolation, but they provide the foundation of the science that universities and states and even businesses look to when they're trying to figure out whether their chemicals are safe, whether they're trying to figure out what the regulatory future holds. The science office gives them a really standardized methodology and the standardized practices that makes it all predictable, that people can figure out and businesses can figure out what products are safe, what products are not, and going to run into trouble. Without those guidelines, without that basic scientific capacity, it's going to be the Wild West out there. We have enough trouble with the chemicals that we know cause health problems. And, you know, without EPA scientists at work, we're really not going to know what is being put in our water, what's being put in the food we eat, what's being put in the air we breathe.
I want to fixate for just a moment, Jeremy, on the scenario you mentioned, and that was the anthrax attack. So just for instance, if that were to happen in the world of a decimated EPA, a white powder could show up at federal or state offices anywhere, even to individuals. And the EPA conceivably could be in a position to throw up its hands and say, got nothing. Is that too far from reality to speculate?
Not at all. I mean, the phone's going to ring. Who's going to be there to answer it? I mean, EPA staff right now, not only are they being laid off in massive numbers, the few that will remain are being treated as less than human, right? They're being treated as some source of a problem when all they've done is set aside potentially more lucrative careers, more prestigious careers to do a public service. And so it's a real problem when you think about who's going to answer the phone when the emergency happens. And, you know, maybe you have someone that was newly hired, doesn't have the experience having been through those events in the past. Maybe there's nobody there at all. Maybe they just make it up as they go. You know, we see what happened down in Texas with the awful tragedy down there. And it's, I mean, take a moment and recognize that, yeah, people talk about saving money and chainsaws and other things, but, you know, it's when disaster strikes that you really realize what you've lost. And for most Americans, it's not going to come in the form of that kind of an attack. It's going to come in the form of everyday threats that are now invisible in our environment, of what we face with toxic chemicals in our home, air pollution, or water pollution where our kids swim and play, and fish. You know, those are the pieces that we take for granted that there are scientists at work to try to at least shine a light on these issues. We have a right to know what is dangerous and what is not. And that's being fundamentally taken away.
In fact, let me take this up with Gretchen, because Gretchen, if you're just tuning in, is co-founder and web monitoring program leader at the Environmental Data and Governance Initiative. You were just listening to Jeremy Simons, senior advisor at the Environmental Protection Network. Gretchen, I want to talk for a minute about your organization, EDGY, and Jeremy just used the phrase, the right to know, and EDGY is devoted to the environmental right to know. So let's start with that principle. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's right. So the environmental right to know is our right to know, as Jeremy said, what are the environmental issues that affect us? What is our government doing about that? What are they not doing about that? What's needed to address these issues to keep us safe? This all came out of a horrible disaster, chemical disaster in Bhopal, India in the early 1980s, where people in that community didn't even know that there were these extremely toxic chemicals being held at a facility in their community. And many, many people died as a consequence of an explosion there. And so since then, it's become really foundational. We have a right to know what are these issues that affect our lives. And so EDGY, our mission is to advance the environmental right to know, to make sure that we have the information and the data that we need to be able to understand, take action, and advocate for our government to take the actions that we want to see to address these environmental issues so that we have, you know, a healthy environment that we all can thrive in.
I want to talk about the nature of being a .org at this time, because this is envirodatagov.org. Not too long ago, I interviewed the people behind the Wayback Machine, the Web Archive. They were very careful to emphasize that their work is apolitical, that what they're doing is documenting and preserving what is on government websites, White House websites, and others before the transition of president to president, and that they have consistently done this even before that information appeared to be in danger. Part of their caution, my impression was, is because they are a .org. They have got, tax considerations. They have the limitations of what a tax-exempt organization is allowed to do. And I think what we're all talking about at this point, by its very nature, is and has to be political. So talk, if you can here, Gretchen, about the work of EDGY, how it manages to hold the line and do the necessary research in a world where this has become so politicized. Facts are politicized.
That's a great question. So we too are a nonprofit, and we are apolitical in the sense that we do not lobby, that we are not calling up legislators and lobbying for specific legislation. We're not doing crowd campaigns to tell people to call their senator about various legislation. We provide information services to people to do what they will with. So we provide research. We do a lot of analyses. We also safeguard information. All that means is we've taken public information that is publicly available, and we've decided to store it ourselves also and make that copy of it also publicly available. And so that is an information service. It's in no way kind of even coming close to crossing over into what would be a 501c4 category, sort of a political organization category. We're squarely in information service and analysis and research. But as you said, obviously, the reason that our work is so important right now is because information is under threat. And so we do need to respond to that moment, but it doesn't mean that we're changing our tactics and that we're becoming a political entity. Mm-hmm. But what we are doing is really revving up our research and information dissemination services so that the public continues to have access to the information they need to do what their own choice with, if that's advocating for environmental justice, if that's advocating for greater government oversight, whatever they want to do with that information, we're providing it. And we're also contextualizing it, with a historical analysis and more of a full bodied analysis of where does this information and data come from? Why is it important? And what are some of the missing features that may have been suppressed recently?
I'm going to stay with you, Gretchen, for one more question. That is with EDGY positing itself as, and I'm quoting from the site here, a forerunner in developing a new field of inquiry and critique, environmental data justice. Now, our listeners are very up on environmental justice per se. We cover that a lot. But what is environmental data justice?
So environmental data justice is the exploration of the tensions between environmental justice and data justice. Right now, our lives are surveilled by corporations that are looking at our phone usage. All of my settings are turned to, no voice activated anything, but somehow I can have a conversation with my partner about shoes that I've never worn before that are actually for her. And that, 20 minutes later, on an ad feed is these kind of shoes.
Yes, yes.
We are being constantly surveilled, and that is not justice. We have a right to privacy, but that's often in tension with the right to transparency that we often advocate for. And so taking into that complexity into account is what data environmental data justice is about. Is really getting down to how do we handle these intersecting issues justly, and it's not it's not easy. If these were not complex issues, we wouldn't have to worry about them. But instead, you know, we really do need to dial in to understand how do we protect people in all of the ways. And so that's really, environmental data justice really explores the synergies and the tensions between environmental justice and data justice.
Got it. Jeremy, I want to go back to you and talk about the national climate assessments. There have been five of those done since 2000. And the first of these congressionally mandated reports was released. Talk about what these reports are and why they matter.
Let me start. If I could just, before we go to the national climate assessment, give a shout out to Gretchen, because I just want to add, we really value the work that EDGE does. Environmental Protection Network, we're a network of former EPA staff. So we think about all those public servants who have spent decades working in across regions across the country. We provide an active voice to do things like we're doing right now, have conversations about what's really going on and provide facts. But EDGE has been a really critical partner in capturing the body of knowledge that's been created and is intentionally being tried to be suppressed. And the National Climate Assessment is, you know, one clear illustration of that. This report is mandated by Congress. Mm-hmm. There aren't very many things that Congress has done on a bipartisan basis that deal with climate change. Asking for science-based information was actually one of them. It's a government-wide process. EPA is just one participant in it. And the important thing that the National Climate Assessment does that no other report does is it brings the best of the science inside and outside government together to ask the question, what does this mean for America? What does continued acceleration of greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere that are heating up our planet, leading to climate disasters at an increasing rate, what does that mean if you're a farmer in the Midwest? What does it mean for you? If you live in a coastal community, what does it mean for you? If you can't get insurance any longer because of climate disasters, which is increasingly happening, that's something that the National Assessment first warned about many years ago. If you're someone that suffered from wildfires and wildfire smoke, that you don't remember having happened. It wasn't really a threat 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Again, we had an early warming system on that. The headlights into the fog ahead, right, into the darkness ahead has been the National Climate Assessment. And the science gets better and better. It's even getting to the point where it can attribute with much more precision the climate disasters to whether or not global warming and greenhouse gas emissions have a fingerprint on each disaster. We're able to attribute that now, scientists are. And that is really inconvenient to some of the nation's biggest polluters who now seem to be in charge, certainly of what's going on at EPA as well as other agencies.
Well, in fact, at the risk of stating the obvious, it does appear that one seeming goal of stifling research is to prevent future regulations. Because if a government is making decisions, it's statutorily required to consider data that could pertain to their decisions. And that data, as in this case, could point to pollution and sea level rise, more frequent natural disasters. But if there's no data, it doesn't have to take those factors into account. Is it just conjecture, Gretchen, that is the scheme going on here? Or is there a smoking gun that says, this is exactly what's happening, this is why the data is being taken away?
Well, they're not going around saying, we're taking down this data for this and leaving a paper record of the why behind it. But I would say that it's pretty clear what the objectives are, especially because, you know, if you look at the policy objectives that are clear in the EPA's historic day of deregulation, as they called it, and in what you're seeing coming out of the Federal Register in terms of the deregulatory efforts, climate policy is on the chopping block, and it just so happens that also climate information is on the chopping block. However, I also wanted to point out something that's sort of interesting. During the first Trump administration, one of the very first targets of their information suppression was climate change information. You saw EPA take down its climate change website on Trump's 99th day in office the first time around. But the EPA climate change website is still up and actually has seen only one change since January 20th, which was a remove to the a removal of the term climate equity. But the climate resources that are being taken down are those from NOAA in particular, and then also the U.S. Global Change Research Program, who has the National Climate Assessments. What's interesting to me here is that those are the ones that are congressionally mandated. NOAA has a mandate to provide public, accessible public information about climate change. And actually, back in March, even put up on NOAA's flagship environmental or climate education website, climate.gov, they put up a banner saying, you know, here are our statutory authorities. They also put that same information up on their climate policy office about page. And yet those are the ones that are being targeted to be taken down. I think that's just really interesting right now. It's also interesting that climate information, while it is being taken down, the topic that was the first and by far the most comprehensive removal so far has been about environmental justice and equity. There are zero federal agencies right now that still have an environmental justice webpage.
Our guests today, as we talk about this disappearing data from federal government sites, Gretchen Gerke, just heard her voice, co-founder and web monitoring program leader at the Environmental Data and Governance Initiative. We have to Jeremy Simons, senior advisor at the Environmental Protection Network, who in fact used to work at the Environmental Protection Agency. It's time to open up our phone lines and our email to get your contributions to our conversation. Said phone lines are 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. What ways do you interact with government data about your environment? Have you gone to these government websites? Are you looking for and are you trusting the data that you see? Have you seen anything vanish? Have you chosen not to move somewhere because of air pollution? Are you using this kind of data to make that kind of decision? Do you check the water quality before you go swimming? If you garden, have you ever looked for data about soil contaminants, and are you worried that some of that will become less available? We'd like your questions, your phone comments, and your email, 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. If you'd rather email us, we are watching the inbox. We're here for you at yourcall@kalw.org. Taking a brief break here, and we'll be right back on your call. It's Your Call. I'm Angie Quirer in for Rose Aguilar today. Our episodes are available on our podcast page. That's at kalw.org/yourcall. You can sign up for our newsletter while you're there. You can submit your show ideas as well. We're grateful for those. Drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org, or give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's the same number you can use right now for show contributions, 866-798-8255. One thing I would like to bring to your attention before we go back to our conversation, we're grateful you are tuning in for this show. We're grateful that you tell other people about this show. This is part of KALW's mission to bring you accurate, up-to-date information on the things that matter in your life. As you probably know, KALW, like many in public media, is navigating the soon-to-be elimination of our federal funding, not unrelated to our conversation today. Your monthly donation allows us to survive. It protects and powers this essential source of fact-based information. Give now. If you value this and you can afford to support us, give now at kalw.org to help us through this period of transition. You can also call 800-525-9917 to make your donation. This is an annual loss for KALW of over $400,000, effective immediately. $400,000 annually is our loss. That means financial support from members like you will be crucial to fund local stories, music, culture, and this kind of coverage that you hear on KALW. Stories that expand your horizons and connect you to the Bay Area. We are the Bay Area's public radio station. This is one way you can help resist the fight against truth. So please give now while you are thinking about it. Go online right now to kalw.org. You'll see a large donate button there, or you can make the phone call if you prefer to 800-525-9917. And thank you for your help in this very urgent time. Let's talk about the Trump administration, Jeremy, considering a rule that would drop reporting requirements for power plants and other greenhouse gas emitters. We were talking earlier about who might benefit from the lack of data and the lack of regulation. Eliminating greenhouse gas reporting looks like something that moves in exactly that direction. Is your thought on that, Jeremy?
Yeah, well, it's all the same theme. You have to recognize this is all connected to the same set of motives, which is that, you know, polluters that don't want to be held accountable under the Clean Air Act, under the Clean Water Act, have been advocating for a widespread agenda to deregulate, right? To basically, in the case of greenhouse gases, literally allow unlimited amounts of pollution by rolling back smokestack and tailpipe, you know, regulations. And so these, what we're seeing on attempts to eliminate, in this case, emissions reporting, where the biggest sources of emissions around the country have to report on their greenhouse gases, is all part of the same theme, which is they don't want to have to acknowledge what individual polluters are up to, and also what the overall impacts of that will be. You know, for example, if you look at that data that we get from that reporting system, you can see that the fastest growing sources of greenhouse gas pollution in the country have been from plastics and the increase in petrochem communities, as well as these mega facilities being built primarily along the Gulf Coast to export LNG, natural gas that increasingly is being shipped out of the country. And these kinds of trends are important to identify, but they're not something that the companies want to advertise. It's also a tool for local communities to be able to understand what the neighbors next door is coming over the fence line. A lot of this pollution, a lot of the challenges we have today, a lot of the reason this information is so important is because a lot of this pollution is invisible, right? And if you don't have the data, if you don't have the information, you just don't know.
Mm-hmm. We're going to go to the phone lines. Greg in Palo Alto wants to chime in on this topic. Greg, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. This just occurred to me, I'm not sure why, as I was listening to this conversation, and that is, I fully understand why the administration is doing what they're doing and why, you know, the corporate entities and wealthy backers are doing this. But it seems to me that we've got a Supreme Court that seems to be able or willing to go along with this. I'm just wondering if there isn't anybody in that Supreme Court who wonders what kind of a government are we going to be left with once they carry this all out? I mean, what kind of purpose is that going to serve? Who's going to be able to serve? And, you know, what are they going to be able to do? I mean, we're going to have a government that's going to be virtually, you know, shrunk down to nothing. And you just wonder what they're going to be able to do. What's their plan? I think there must be somebody on that Supreme Court who's wondering, my God, these people want to dismantle the entire federal government.
Greg, you really put your finger on the pulse, the bottom line of what's happening with this. And the question is, if there are people who are on the Supreme Court who think that way, how many of them are? And I wonder for you, Gretchen, if at EDGY, this is the kind of concern that people are coming to you with, that, you know, whether you're shoveling against the tide here and they're wondering about the resilience of our own government to work against this kind of thing.
Absolutely. One of our core motivations is to be more resilient to this kind of attack. And people are coming, especially because with this information suppression, that we're seeing, in addition to the policies, you know, the information suppression allows these policies to move forward. Because if people don't have access to information and data, that allows them to demonstrate or learn about these issues, especially about the inequities that exist, then they can't, you know, not only create future better policies, but also can't push back on deregulation that will have harmful effects. And so there is, you know, you create an information vacuum, you pretend a problem doesn't exist, and then you move forward with these, with your political agenda. And so that, you know, our democracy is eroding because our access to information, which is a pillar of democracy, so that we can have our informed opinion and voice that opinion at the ballot box and in our other civic engagement activities, that opportunity is being eroded right now. And that is a core fundamental question. And the question about the Supreme Court specifically, you know, last June, the Supreme Court handed Congress a lot more power and stripped power from agencies when they rescinded the Chevron doctrine and basically said, if something's not prescripted in a law, then the agencies no longer really get discretion in how to then implement it, which is antithetical to how bills and regulations are supposed to work. But with that, it stripped power from agencies, handed it back to Congress. But as we can see, Congress has not been able to do much. And so there, we have created the situation where we're trying to put more power back into Congress, but Congress has abdicated their power back to the executive branch. And so we are kind of from all angles seeing power being concentrated specifically in the office of the president. And that's a problem.
If you want to pick up caller Greg's phone line, that's 866-798-8255 to bring your comments and questions to the air, 866-798-TALK. You can also email us your questions and comments. That's your call at klw.org. Jeremy, do you know what is in the pipeline in terms of legal challenges with the disappearance of information?
Yeah, let me just say, you know, the Chevron doctrine and the recent cases on that Gretchen mentioned, this idea that agencies need to be more accountable to the law really flies in the face of the attacks that we're seeing at EPA on information, on regulations. I mean, it's ironic, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, these are American success stories, right? We have had enormous success protecting our environment while growing the economy. We've led the world. They're examples to the world. They're actually much more specific. They're much more clear than most laws in other areas. And so you have these issues as they go before the Supreme Court and the lower courts on whether the agency will actually be held accountable to those laws or not. The concern, I think Greg, you know, gets at this is, can we count on the Supreme Court to be consistent and recognize the value of those laws, or they just really want this administration to sort of give it a free pass? And we just don't know the answer to that. There are challenges to a number of what's going on legally. The administration, is on very shaky ground legally on a number of the issues that it's facing, and they know that. And that's why there's another element to this whole story we haven't talked about yet that's also extremely disturbing. The way this EPA is handling this is they've decided that they can just act unilaterally and basically give an unprecedented presidential pardon, an amnesty, if you will, to polluters, so that they don't have to follow the Clean Air Act, even as these issues are playing out in the courts. This is a novel, this is a mountain out of molehill from a narrow provision in the Clean Air Act that's never been misused for this purpose before. But they have, just this last week, President Trump and EPA Administrator Zeldin gave free pass to more than 100 of the biggest polluters across the country. We're talking about refineries, we're talking about power plants, we're talking about chemical industry that basically says, we actually don't know what they have to comply with because they've been given this new form of presidential exemption, a presidential waiver. So even as this plays out in the court, and it can take years, they basically said, we're not just stopping the regulations that Joe Biden put in place. We're actually basically giving you a pass across the board on a number of these standards. And it is, you know, you combine that with the lack of information that we're going to have from reporting, not only self-reporting, but also air pollution monitors, where we're starting to get to a point and we don't know we can rely on the information coming out of this EPA. It's a really sad state of affairs. How these pieces layer on top of each other, on how they're trying to really demolish the capability of the public to protect themselves and to speak up and to know what's going on.
You know, what's really interesting, I was going to ask later in our conversation, but let's ask it now, because you just described, Jeremy, a really dismal situation where all of our checks and balances are at least in disarray, if not facing existential threat. If you thought this were hopeless, you would throw up your hands and go home. You wouldn't be with the Environmental Protection Network. You'd be on some island somewhere. So I'm wondering, what keeps you going in the face of something this dismal?
So that's a great question. I'm glad you asked it, because I firmly believe, I've been in this space for a long time. We did a poll at EPN that literally the day after the election, and we asked voters whether or not they want to see a stronger EPA or weaker EPA. Do they want to see more funding or less funding for EPA? Not only did we find that 86% of the public don't want a weakened EPA, more than three quarters of Trump voters want either a stronger EPA or stay the same. So think about that for a moment. Like, what? How is this going on? I mean, look, every administration, again, I've worked for, you know, EPA staff work for Republican and Democratic administrations. It's a non-political civil service job. We've seen changes. Every administration wants, you know, to tell the news story based on their agenda. What we're seeing here with this fundamental attempt to simultaneously strip away people's ability to know and to have information while giving a free pass to polluters and deregulating, in a skill we haven't seen before. The public didn't sign up for this. Mm-hmm. They did not sign up for this. There was no debate. When President Trump was asked about the environment, he promised clean air and clean water in the presidential debates. Now, whether or not people believed, you know, some people, most people probably weren't paying attention because we take it for granted. I don't think people really understand how much this is going to affect their health and what's going on. And so what you're seeing with Texas, for example, and with the administration already backtracking on FEMA, and we'll say, well, maybe we shouldn't get rid of FEMA. I think this is a political agenda. It was part of Project 2025. It's being run by narrow special interests. But once we shine some sunlight, as you are doing, on these problems, I do believe that people across the aisle are going to demand better. I really don't think people signed up for this.
Well, I want to take that very conversation over to Gretchen. Gretchen, there was a story a few months back in which the farmers, who are, to a great number, if not a majority number, are Republican voters, they sued the Trump administration about data the Department of Agriculture took off the internet. And that means maps, there was information about federal funding, clean energy products, and a lot of that was related to the potential impacts of climate change on farming. And they said, we need this information. We've got decisions to make about our crops. And the USDA gave in. They put the information back online rather than face the lawsuit. So that is essentially an across-the-aisle conversation that went against what the Trump administration is doing. I want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that is actually one of the examples I was thinking of providing, thinking about, you know, what gives me hope, what gives us, you know, kind of motivation to keep on pushing, and it's issues like that. So in that lawsuit, so I'll preface this by saying, we don't have great information policies in this country. We our information policies are not prepared for the digital age. And so it's actually pretty tricky to bring a lawsuit about the removal of information, data and information from a website. But we have seen so far two successful lawsuits do this. And they're leaning on the Paperwork Reduction Act and the Administrative Procedure Act and the Freedom of Information Act to do this successfully. And I have been really impressed with how these law firms have found footing in those, even though we actually don't have great information policies here. But what happened there is that the farmers said, you know, this is harming us, this removal of information. They demonstrated the harm, and they demonstrated that the administration was operating in an arbitrary and capricious manner. Mm-hmm. And that means they're, you know, they're not being reasoned with their decisions. This is what hamstrung the Trump administration the first time around as well. The first Trump administration lost 80% of its cases in court, mostly because of acting arbitrary and capricious. They weren't careful. And we're seeing them repeat that same pattern. And we need to hone in on that in these lawsuits in order to be successful. And so far that's happened twice now, both with the USDA and then also with a similar situation with the CDC, Department of Health and Human Services, and FDA. Although in that case, it did go to court, and that was a judge that ordered the data and information back online. In the case of the USDA, the USDA wanted to avoid that lawsuit, probably because they saw what happened with the CDC case.
And it sounds like any feelings of hopelessness about our court system might be a little exaggerated at this point then, because it was, in fact, a court challenge that made that less plausible for the government to be able to do what it wanted to do.
Yes, I'd say so. The courts are, you know, it's not always the decisions that I want to see, but the courts are operating as a line of defense, as they did the last Trump administration as well. And I also want to say the other thing that really is motivating right now is seeing the people that are coming together to protect our regulations, our information, our government, and to protect the programs that support people. You're seeing people from all different walks of life join in the movement. Some people are in the streets protesting. Some people are at their computers downloading data. Some people are, you know, talking to teachers about, you know, do you want to be able to share, you know, information about evolution, you know, kind of basics. Mm-hmm. There are people in all different walks of life banding together to protect information, to protect the American people from being gaslit. And I think that is also really powerful to see how many different people are playing so many different roles and working together. And that's been really motivating to us in EDGY.
Well, along that conversation, EDGY is part of a larger coalition. It's called the Public Environmental Data Partners. It seems like the coalition is getting wider and wider of groups who understand the threat, who are saving the data, and even reconstructing data-related tools. Can you talk about the ED partners? Public Environmental Data Partners?
Yes. Yeah, so we launched this coalition in November. Basically, we were starting our data preservation efforts and saw that other groups were as well, and said, let's join forces and do this efficiently and effectively as we can to be able to cast a wider net and safeguard more resources. So there are at least a dozen organizations involved and, you know, 100 volunteers, and we've worked with stakeholders from environmental justice groups to government oversight groups to state and local governments to understand what are the environmental and climate data and tools that are necessary for these people's work, and identified those. It's got a list about 300 different federally published environmental data and tools, and have prioritized, you know, and gone down the list. We're going to safeguard all of these key data and also rebuild critical tools that were the Environmental Justice Screening Tool, EJ Screen from EPA, and the White House Climate and Economic Justice Screening Tool, or CJEST, were from all of the different stakeholders that we spoke with. Those were the two most highly requested tools, saying, we need these to do our jobs. We need these to feed our state program information. We need these to be able to advocate for our community's health. And so both of those tools were taken offline. The CGES was taken offline on January 21st. And then in early February, EJ Screen was taken offline. And our coalition, the Public Environmental Data Partners, was able to rebuild each of those and get them back up online about 48 hours after the official tool had been taken down.
Wow, that's great. Jeremy, I want to go over to you because you were talking earlier about some of the promises made on the campaign trail by Donald Trump. And I do want to play devil's advocate here because one of the promises he made again and again was to cut the fat, cut the bloat in the government. EPA staffing has been reduced. This is according to the New York Times, reduced since Trump took office from a little more than 16,000 employees. In fact, 16,155 employees to about 12,500, which means about 3,700 EPA employees have left the agency or been fired. And I'm wondering about the perspective our audience might think about here. They might think, well, look, 12,000 people is an awful lot. And was every single one of those 16,000 plus employees absolutely necessary? So from your position as a former EPA insider, is it possible some elements of this, is there a legit reduction of bloat?
Well, keep in mind that the Environmental Protection Agency's budget is about 2/10 of a single penny for every dollar of government spending. This agenda has nothing to do with saving money. I was just looking at that, a budget came out of the House budget bill just today, and the enforcement cuts, that they want to cut EPA enforcement in half. In that budget, think about all those folks that are doing investigations and taking to court on illegal dumping of air pollution and water pollution and known violations. Those hundreds of employees around the country who are being taken off, their entire budget adds up to less than 0.1% of all the new ICE agents that have been recently, through the recent budget bill, have been added to the rolls. So it's about priorities, right? And mm-hmm. and it's not about cost savings. It's about taking EPA off the job. If there wanted to be a reasoned conversation about EPA's budget, you know, our volunteers, and we go to the Hill, and, you know, we want to have that conversation of priorities and where you spend money. But that's not what this is. This is a political agenda. This is a reckless agenda. And it's really, really unprecedented. It's also important to realize that EPA's budget is really, in inflation adjusted terms, is lower than it's ever been, you know, in the last several decades. It's been steadily eaten away at, and that is happening at a time when we have new threats from climate change to microplastics, forever chemicals, toxic chemicals, you know, new requirements from Congress, all the different pieces. So there's been a real strain in the system that really works at odds with what's being done here. This is wasting money. This isn't saving money. When you take the science office away, you're not saving money. You're just putting that money onto families that are going to pay it medical bills because they're dealing with asthma, they're dealing with cancer, they're dealing with problems that could easily be avoided if we took some common sense steps to continue to reduce pollution. And that's what's really going on here.
In terms of communicating the dangers there, Gretchen, there is a former EPA principal deputy assistant administrator. I'm going to mangle her name, I'm sure, Jennifer Orme Zavaleta. And she made a statement saying reducing its workforce, the EPA's workforce, under the guise of cost savings is both misleading and dangerous. This does not save taxpayers money. It simply shifts costs to hospitals, families, and communities left to bear the health and economic consequences of increased pollution and weakened oversight. The people of this country are not well served by these actions. They're left more vulnerable. And I wonder, two different things here, Gretchen. One is that whether putting it in terms of the things we encounter every day, hospitals and our own families and our communities, if that helps to convey the message of what's at stake here, but also how many people are actually hearing that?
I mean, it's a great question. I don't think that because of the information silos that we live in, I don't think that the people who need to hear this information the most are necessarily hearing it. And I think that Jennifer is absolutely right. This is, you know, shifting the burden onto people who are then going to be experiencing, you know, greater exposure, greater harms. You know, in every situation, preventative measures are less costly than responsive measures. You know, if you prevent a disaster, that you spend less money in your preventative work than in rebuilding after a disaster. And in this case, we're just getting rid of our ability to prevent more disasters. And, you know, and we're doing this also at a time that we're, you know, cutting, you know, funding for hospitals. So I live in North Carolina. So many rural hospitals are closing, and more are going to close because of this one big, beautiful bill. You know, and at a time that we are also, this state, we're very much affected by PFAS and you know, kind of hamstringing our ability to actually address that issue, expose more people to it, and cut off our medical services when we need to, you know, seek help because of those exposures. This is not about saving costs, and it is not about protecting people. As Jeremy said, this is a political endeavor.
Gosh, I wish I had another hour with each of you. Gretchen Gerke, co-founder and web monitoring program leader at the Environmental Data and Governance Initiative, and Jeremy Simon, senior advisor at the Environmental Protection Network. You can find all of the information about today's show. You can check out our previous shows at kalw.org/yourcall. Email us with your questions, comments, and show suggestions, yourcall@kalw.org. Andrew Stelzer helped produce today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Sitting in for Rose Aguilar, I'm Angie Cuero. Thank you for tuning in to Your Call and for supporting KALW.